Stein. Mr. Ovier.
May it please the Court, good morning, Counsel. Your Honors, this case involves, as you're aware from the facts, Mr. Stein was represented by another attorney in Door County back in 2008. It was a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. The issue here is not whether Mr. Stein was a disqualified person or not. The issue is his state of mind and reasons why Mr. Stein believed, when represented in district court, for being indicted on a charge of possession of a firearm by a person previously convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, if he would have been permitted to present evidence of his state of mind.
Wouldn't we have to all but overrule our decision in Carlton Wilson to hold as you wish?
Your Honor, I think there are distinctions that I'd like to point out. And first of all, the line of cases that starts with Wilson in 1998, then the other Wilson case in 2006, and I've also pointed out in my brief discussion about the Ballantyne case in 1993, all of those cases stem from the general principle, as we all know, that ignorance of the law in and of itself cannot provide a defense. But in each of these cases, specifically in the first Wilson case, it dealt with whether or not...
Well, he was warned, wasn't he, that that the state wasn't advising him about possible federal consequences?
Yes, and the problem...
Well, doesn't that put him on notice that there may be a problem if he possesses a gun and maybe he should ask someone about that?
The way that the transcript reads on that particular point is that the court can't give you any particular advice,
right.
But if you go to buy a gun sometime in the future, you may encounter a problem. But it wasn't specific with regard to weapons that he already owned. And the problem here is that we have numerous examples throughout the process. I know the government has pointed out.
But he was told he could get into trouble with the federal government.
The specific words that if he tried to buy one. That's exactly how it was portrayed to him. He's receiving advice throughout this process, both while on probation and in attempts to be released early from probation, brought by his attorney so he can go hunting with guns.
Why didn't they ask his lawyer?
He did. That's precisely
the evidence. Well, so his problem may be there, but I would go back to the Carlton Wilson case. He knows what he did. You know, he beat up his girlfriend, knocked out her teeth. And so it was... So there's no question about that, and he knows that efforts are being made to ameliorate the effects of that conviction on his future. It seems to me there's a lot of knowledge in this record, and it may not be the best case for the proposition you'd like us to adopt, even if we were inclined to adopt it.
Well, I agree. But these are the facts that we're dealing with today.
Well, I know it, but I mean, if knowledge is important, he seems to have knowledge, and people have told him.
But I think that's the dispute, Your Honor, and we never had a trial on that issue because that evidence was precluded. And
how can people who are mentally ill, who are also under 922G, disqualified from having guns, ever have the kind of knowledge that's necessary? They're mentally ill, so they don't think clearly.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would say that consistent with the other cases that we've seen from this circuit, we're dealing with a lack of information that's been supplied to the person.
Well, I'm pointing out that in other sections of the statute, knowledge is not critical because there are, in fact, some people. Maybe you do know you've committed a felony. Let's just put that to one side. But there are some sections of the statute for which knowledge is almost by definition impossible, and yet those people are disqualified. Or if they do have a gun, they've violated 922.
Well, let me use another example.
Would you agree with that? Somebody mentally ill would have violated 922 if they have a gun?
Yes.
Okay.
I would. And, again, the distinction here is that in Mr. Stein's case, he's being affirmatively told by his attorney that there's no problem owning a firearm, possessing a firearm.
What difference does that make? Suppose your attorney says, actually, if you embezzle money from your employer, everything's going to be fine. I mean, if you go ahead and embezzle it, the fact that your attorney told you that isn't helpful.
Well, believe it or not, I looked for any precedent under this set of fact patterns, and shockingly, there was none, given the fact that there appears to have been...
Well, because it's a fairly recent field of litigation, let's say. It's the post-Heller world. the post-Scoyan world, which is this very section before our court and bank.
And I think that the court can see from a review of the transcripts there is ambiguity along the way. Even in the government's appendix at page 41, there are notes along the way where the attorney, Brett Reitz, is calling the agent, and I'm quoting here, the rules, Attorney Reitz threatened to file a lawsuit and complained about agent participation in, quote, bastardizing the Second Amendment. And this is an example of how, through the process going on, even up until the point where the...
Why would anyone think you could have a gun, but you couldn't buy another one?
I have no idea. I'm not the one that gave him that advice.
And isn't bottom line here the fact that, you know, when he pled guilty to the battery, the judge warned him there was no guarantee he would be able to keep his guns. And by the time he moved for early termination of probation, it was clear that, in fact, it would be illegal for him to possess a gun, and he was so apprised.
I agree that the transcript contains language to that effect, primarily, most forcefully, from the district attorney's office, not so much from the judge. He talks about some unnamed case that may have changed things, and essentially that he's not going to get involved in that dispute is the complete reading of everything that's in there. But if I can draw another analogy here, it's also unlawful for a person who is illegally in this country as an alien to possess a firearm. And there are cases where a person has no idea that they actually are an illegal alien because they have been in the country since the age of 2 months and so forth. And in those types of cases, I would seriously question whether the United States could sustain a prosecution when someone has no knowledge at all given their situation.
The question would be whether the focus is on whether you know that you have the gun, which is usually pretty obvious, unless there's some fancy constructive possession argument, which is certainly not Mr. Stein's case, or it's whether you should know that you're unlawfully in the country, which, as you point out, you know, it's conceivable somebody might not be sure, and we've even seen cases where there are common law marriages and it turns out somebody's really a U.S. citizen after all. So the relevant knowledge that you're focusing on, Mr. Stein has. He knows he doesn't want to give up his guns. He finally reluctantly gives them to his mother.
I agree that if we're talking about the knowledge element that relates to whether or not he possessed firearms is one component.
And he knows he's committed a misdemeanor. He's lucky it wasn't a felony. It gets pleaded down to a misdemeanor. Battery crime. This isn't subtle battery where you poke somebody in the arm. This is pretty obvious battery.
Oh, certainly he was aware.
He's guilty.
He was aware of the conduct that resulted in his conviction. But as you can see, the negotiations that led to the disposition of the case specifically contemplated his ongoing right to continue.
Which are all about trying to get around federal law, which the judge and various people tell him they can't do.
I just wanted to point out that in the first Wilson case that deals with the protective order and whether or not that provided fair warning under a Fifth Amendment analysis, essentially. In Wilson 2, the 2006 case, that dealt with the notice that the person received that his civil rights had been restored, but not his firearms rights, and there was the language that Wilson in that case challenged, citing that he didn't tell me anything about the ammo. Again, a lack of information, an absence of information. And finally, in Ballantyne, there is discussion about what the knowledge requirement being more than simply, and it's not in relation to his status, but a fugitive from justice does have to know that he had a court date, that he left the jurisdiction, and that he did not appear. So he must at least know something about
So all you're saying status. Is that there is a mens rea requirement for some elements of some crimes, and there isn't for others, and your problem is we've said there wasn't one for this particular.
Correct, and we never had the trial that we wanted, is the point.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Ogre. Mr. Giampetro.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Gordon Giampetro on behalf of the United States. I think the government's brief in this case, for which I can take no credit, sets forth the reasons why, under the law and the facts, the defendant loses. So unless the Court has any questions for me, I'm prepared to rest on the brief and sit down.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Giampetro.
Thank you.
Okay. Case will be taken under advisement.